So Milarepa, if you imagined flying into Tibet, which may seem a bit anachronistic because we're talking about the 11th century, but it's not really, because Milarepa himself, according to legend, liked to fly around. So if you imagined flying into Tibet following the river, the Brahmaputra River, which comes from the, is it the South China Sea into Bangladesh, flows through Bangladesh into India, and then enters Tibet in the Himalayan mountains, where it becomes the Tsang River, one of the great rivers of Tibet, and it flows through a huge mountain valley, really, when I say huge, I mean twice the size of Great Britain or something like that, really vast. And then, if I remember correctly, it ends up, or I should say it starts off, in Lake Anapatapta, the source of the four lived rivers of India, which is a sacred lake inhabited by dragons, according to legend, at the foot of Mount Kailash. Mount Kailash is known in India as Mount Meru. And that river valley, the valley of the Tsang River, is where Milarepa was born, and in various areas around that valley and in the mountains around it is where he lived his whole life. So if we fly in, I've got a picture here of Milarepa flying. I don't know if you can see that. So if you imagine doing this, this is from a graphic novel that was produced by a very good Dutch artist some time ago. And it shows Milarepa, green in colour, flying through the air towards the top of Mount Everest. But if we come down a bit and see a little village near the banks of the river, we'll be coming into Milarepa's birthplace. And in that village, there's one house which is far larger than any of the others. And this was known as the House of the Eight Beams and the Four Pillars. The House of the Eight Beams and the Four Pillars. And it was built by Milarepa's father. And Milarepa's father had made his fortune trading in wool. And with this money, he'd built this house. He had a lot of land in the village. Many of his relatives lived around there. And there Milarepa was born. And the father was far away when the news of his new baby, his firstborn child, arrived. And he called him joyful to hear. Sometimes translated into English as good news, but joyful to hear is the literal translation. And that's quite a premonition, really, because it's not just that his father was happy to hear that he had a son, but there's also the fact that Milarepa himself was enormously enjoyable to listen to because of his beautiful singing voice and speaking voice as well. And the family name was Mila. And Mila means something like wow man, in the sense of, you know, impressive man. That's the family name. That was his sort of surname, Mila. And he had a younger sister, 4 years younger than himself, called Petta, who he was very, very close to, very fond of. So far, a good life in either 1040 or 1052, sources disagree, when he was born. But when he was 7 years old, his father fell very seriously ill, and he knew he was dying. And he called around him Petta, and joyful to hear, and their mother. And he called around the relatives, including his brother and sister, who lived in the village, the Milarepa's uncle and aunt. And they all gathered around the bed of the dying man, and he said, well, I'm not long for this world, and I would like you, my brother and my sister, to look after my family. They'll be without a protector, and when my son reaches the age of 15, which was the age of majority in medieval Tibet, I want you to make sure he gets his property and he can follow me in my trade if he wishes. He can be a farmer. And the uncle and aunt promised. But as soon as the father had died, the uncle and the aunt turn into really pantomime villains. I mean, they really are dreadful. And they set Milarepa and his sister and his mother to work as virtually as slaves. They force them to work in the fields. They give them only scraps of food to eat. They give them only rags to wear. And before long, Milarepa and Petta, their head is teeming with lice. They're just like little vagabond children, skinny and emaciated, all of them. And in the mother's heart, a rage, a burning rage, becomes stronger and stronger as she sees the injustice and as she sees the terrible suffering that her children are undergoing, and herself, of course. Then at last, Milarepa reaches the age of 15, the age of majority, and the mother manages to get enough funds together to hold a feast, and she invites the village to the feast. She reminds everybody of the terms of the will of her husband. She says, Milarepa, or joyful to hear, is now 15. He's come of age. It is now time for him to get the house with the four pillars and the eight beams, to get to the fields known as Golden Triangle, the most fertile field in the valley, and the other land and all our possessions. But the uncle and the aunt say, ha! They say, no, 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 no. These never belonged to your husband. They say, we lent it all to him. They are not his. And although the other villagers knew full well what the true situation was, the aunt and the uncle were far too powerful to thwart. And so Milarepa, his sister Petta, and his mother continued in the same slavery as before. And before long, the uncle and the aunt threw them out of the house with the four pillars and the eight beams, the grand mansion, and forced them to live in a hovel. And the mother, after a few years of this, the mother went up to her son and she said, I am determined for revenge. She said, I cannot stand this any longer. You're old enough now. You can go and train. You can train in sorcery. So she sent her son away, some distance away, to a great sorcerer that she'd heard of. She had a small dowry of a field, which I think was called the Fleece or something like that, a little field. And she sold half of that to give him money to give to the sorcerer to pay for his apprenticeship. So the young Milarepa travelled far away, having promised his mother that he would learn sorcery and he would bring vengeance upon his uncle and his aunt. And she said, if you do not do this, I will kill myself, she said. So he went to the sorcerer and he joined his band of apprentices. They lived together and they learnt magic. But I'm afraid the magic was rather of the minor Hogwarts variety, nothing very major. And after a while, the sorcerer said, I've taught you all I know. You can all now disperse to your own homes. And he sent them away. But Milarepa, after he'd gone 100 yards, turned around and he went around the valley with a sack collecting manure. And he took the sack of manure back to the sorcerer's dwelling and he scattered it over his garden as an offering. That's all he had because he'd given everything else away, you see. And the sorcerer was very impressed by this. And Milarepa said, I need to learn something far stronger than what you've taught me so far. And he told him his full story. He told him the story of his mistreatment, his sister's mistreatment, and his mother's mistreatment at the hands of the wicked uncle and the wicked aunt. And the sorcerer was very moved by his story, and he could say, I can see why you want to learn the Black Arts. I, too, feel hatred in my heart against these terrible people. I'll help you to gain your vengeance, but I must first check your story. And he sent a yogic runner all the way back to Milarepa's home village. Now, a yogic runner is somebody, this is in Tibet, who can run, do marathon running, incredibly fast. If you read Lama Govinda's Way of the White Clouds, he describes not only seeing yogic running in action, but actually experiencing it himself. It's a sort of a running meditation where you get into a very deep concentration. And it's as if, even over rough ground, you can sort of leap along in great bounds. And so the 40 miles between the sorcerer's house and Milarepa's village was covered in next to no time by the marathon runner. And he inquired within the village, and he heard the story. He was able to confirm Milarepa's story, and boing, 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 back he goes again to the sorcerer's house. And the sorcerer says, "Oh, very well then, I can teach you this spell. So what we must do is to build a great stone building with no windows on the top of a ridge. And from there, you can cast your spell of vengeance towards your uncle and aunt." So this building was built. This is the first a little apprenticeship of Milarepa in building techniques. He became a professional, I think we could say, builder later on. He was a very strong lad, very, very fit, very willing, very determined, with very little sense of pain. He'd been through so much as a child. And an enormous willpower, he had. So he was set up in this house with the spell. 7 days he spent, 7 days in concentration casting the spell. At the end of 7 days, the sorcerer came to the house and said, "I think that's enough. 7 days is enough." And Milarepa said, "No, it is not enough. Another 7 days, just to be sure. The distance is rather great. And there is, after all, an inverse square law of spell propagation. So one has to make sure it's strong enough to cover the distance." Incidentally, in case anyone's listening to the recording of this, or even you lot, I may have little bits of embroidery in the story here and there. I'm not quite sure. When you're trying to give something as a story, it sometimes evolves a little bit. And indeed, the life story of Milarepa himself was told at his request to Milarepa's closest disciple, his heart son, Rechungpa, who we'll hear more about later probably. And Rechungpa seems to have passed it down to his disciples. And the story is developed into a literary document about 200 years later, a very beautiful literary document. But even that survives in quite a number of different forms. So I make no apology. The story may evolve once again at this stage, but I apologize for any sort of serious inaccuracies. I'm not sure about the inverse square law for sorcery, for example. So we imagine this beam of sorcery coming down the Tsang River Valley toward the little village, and there, in the house with 4 pillars and 8 beams, there is a wedding party. And the wedding party is for Milarepa's uncle's eldest son, who is getting married. And all the guests are gathered. All the enemies of Milarepa and his mother are gathered, 35 of them, for the feast in this house, with all their horses stabled underneath. But the uncle and the aunt have gone out to discuss the wedding speech, apparently. But everyone else is there in the house. And a servant goes out to get some water. And as she goes out and passes the stable, she looks in the stable. And to her horror, the stable appears to be filled with giant scorpions. And she is, like it's a horror movie, and she's absolutely terrified and just runs away screaming. But it's too late for any alarm to be risen. The horses in the stable start to go mad, to go wild. They're thrashing, they're kicking, they're pulling at their reins. And one by one, the 4 pillars holding up the house are demolished by the horses. And down tumbles the house, and every last person inside is killed in the crash. Meanwhile, back in the stone house with no windows, Milarepa is deep in his sorcerer's concentration, and he is shown by the demons of the valley. They bring him 35 dripping heads and 35 dripping hearts. And the sorcerer explains that means that your magic has killed 35 people. So, it's happened. And very soon, Milarepa's mother hears of the tragedy. And she puts some red rags on a stick to make a flag. And she runs up and down through the village, shouting in triumph, and says, "My son, the great sorcerer, has slain his enemies. My son has slain his enemies." And her brother, who has been helping them out during their times of privation, pulls it on and says, "Come on, look, you'll make a terrible scene. The villagers, if they realize who has done this, we will not be able to survive, or at least you won't, you know." And she said, "Well, I'm sorry, but I just couldn't hold it in, you know, my triumph is so great." And the villagers, of course, get very, very worked up, the relatives of the people who are killed and so on, and the uncle and the aunt. And the uncle and the aunt were not killed because they were outside writing the wedding speech. And so they are immediately sort of bound for their own vengeance. And this is what happens, of course, with a feud, isn't it? They want to kill. They want to find and kill Milarepa, and they imagine all sorts of terrible things they're going to do to him. And the mother realizes what great danger he's in. And so she gets a message to him, and she says, "What you have to do is to show your power so that the villagers will respect you and will leave you alone. You must send hailstorms." And so Milarepa goes back to his sorcerer teacher and says, "I need to learn how to send hailstorms." And the teacher says, "Okay, we can teach you the hailstorm method." And what Milarepa has to do here, he goes with the yogic runner, who's a big, strong guy, as well as very fast. The two of them set up camp overlooking the village in the ridge on the mountains above. And there, for 7 days, they go into a deep concentration. And at first, a little tiny white cloud appears, and they think, "Oh, no, we're not good. We're no good. We can't do it." And the yogic runner says, "No, keep on, keep on, keep on, you know." And the cloud grows bigger and bigger until a vast black cloud gathers at the end of the valley, pours down the valley, just as the harvest reaches its peak. This is actually several months later. Just as the harvest reaches its peak, everything is ready to be harvested, and three hailstorms, one after the other, destroy all the crops of all the people in the village. And this may not seem as bad a tragedy as the 35 deaths, but it is actually really serious, because these are farming people. This is their food for the winter. They will now starve for the winter. They will now be beggars trying to get food from neighboring villages. They will be in real trouble. And some of the shepherds in the village see the smoke from Milarepa and the yogic runner's fire, and they think that must be Milarepa, and shouting they run up the hill. But with great presence of mind, Milarepa's friend, the yogic runner, runs. And as he runs, he keeps just stopping just a little bit ahead of the villagers, and pretending to be Milarepa, he shouts taunts over his shoulder. And eventually he shouts threats over his shoulder, and he says, "I'm the great sorcerer Milarepa. If you harm a hair of my head or any of my family, you will all die horrible deaths." And then boing, 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 off he goes and vanishes over the horizon. And meanwhile, Milarepa has made his escape by another route. So here we are. But what is the outcome of this? The outcome of this, in a way, is no better. Milarepa's mother has got her vengeance. She's very happy for a while, but her condition is no better. She doesn't have her land back. She doesn't have the house back. and the uncle and the aunt are still around, still persecuting them. She's there with her daughter, Petta. She's there also in touch with Milarepa's fiancé. Milarepa was betrothed as a young, very young child to a neighbour, a neighbour's daughter called Zese, who does turn up later in the story. And they're also very fond of each other. And what about Milarepa himself? Well, he, more and more, as he ponders over what he's done, he wonders what on earth he's been guilty of. He really does feel this is something dreadful. When he's heard the news of what happened to the 35 people, he's heard the news of the hailstorms, and he starts to feel, this is awful, what I've done is awful. And at the same time, the sorcerer, his teacher, an old man, a close friend of his, a very kind man, is dying and passes away. And the sorcerer is forced to reflect on loss. He's forced to reflect on the meaning of life and so on. He thinks, I myself am not long for this world. What have I got myself involved with? And he determines, I've got to turn to Buddhism, because he knows that Buddhism is a path of non-violence and love, and also is a path whereby you can deal with karmic problems. And he and Milarepa talk this over, and Milarepa himself is very, very distraught by this stage. And gradually there emerges in Milarepa this powerful sense of the evil that he's built up in his own heart, in this intense concentration on destruction and death, like which he's been undergoing for several years. It's formed something inside him. It's formed a great sliver of ice in his own heart. And it terrifies him when he thinks about it. And it's not so much that he's thinking, oh dear, I've done something against the law and I'm going to be thrown in jail. Because at this time, Milarepa was a very lawless land. It didn't even have a centralized government for the whole country. It was a place of bandits, a place of great danger, and you could get away with that kind of thing. That wasn't what Milarepa was worried about. It wasn't even sort of ordinary remorse, you know, oh dear, I shouldn't have done that. That's a bit naughty, isn't it? It's more this intense sense of karma, which maybe is difficult for us to appreciate because we don't live in a culture that's permeated by the idea of karma. But what he realizes is that he's had to set his heart in this sliver of ice, almost in a concrete of evil. And that is going to affect the world that he moves into in the rest of his life and even in future lives. In other words, he's going to see the world through that ice, and he's going to find himself constantly beset by greater and greater suffering. This is the view of karma. If you do this kind of thing, you're going to reap the consequences. And it's not in some kind of a sort of retaliation method by some spirit. It's to do with what your mind has done. Your mind has done that. You've changed your mind. As a result, your mind actually experiences a different world. You will find the people you meet are enemies. They are people who you are afraid of. Paranoia gets stronger and stronger in your mind. And he can feel this growing. And he feels an intense terror when he thinks about the future that he's facing. And what he realizes, he knows enough of Buddhism to know this, is that it's not enough for him simply to mend his ways. Because mending his ways, being a good citizen for the rest of his life, will not melt that sliver of ice in his heart. The only thing that can do that is wisdom. The only thing is wisdom. In other words, he's got to break through and see directly the way his mental states connect with his actions and the way his mental states connect with his underlying mental habits. And he's got to redo those connections. He's got to sort of reach into the very central processing unit, into the very integrated circuits of himself, and he's got to reroute the circuits. He's got to change his own wiring. And that is a very, very big task. And Milarepa has, fortunately, this intense willpower. He knows he must do it. And so he decides to use the Dharma. He decides that Buddhism is the only approach that is going to help him. And not only that, he must break through completely to enlightenment. It's not enough for him just to follow the precepts. So he looks for a lama, for a teacher. And he finds a lama, starts practicing under him. But when the lama, although he's a very good teacher, when he hears his story, he thinks, I can't do this. I cannot cope with this myself. He says to Milarepa, there's only one man who can help you. There is only one man in the whole of Tibet who knows how to deal with this kind of issue, and that man is Marpa, the translator. And as soon as Milarepa hears that name, Marpa, he says that every hair on his body vibrated and tears started pouring from his eyes, and somehow he knew that this was his destined master. This was the one who would give him a route to liberation, complete liberation from the terrible prison that he'd built for himself. So he went in pursuit. He went to look for Marpa. Now, Marpa himself deserves a talk or two all on his own, an amazing character. But a very important man in Tibetan history, because he was one of the main people to bring the Buddhist teachings from India to Tibet. Remember, we're now somewhere around the year 1080 or so. And a couple of hundred years before then, Padmasambhava here had established Buddhism in Tibet. Padmasambhava wasn't the first person to bring Buddhism to Tibet, but before then it had had a very fragile hold. Padmasambhava had made it to be a major part of Tibetan culture. But still, there was a lot of evolution for it to undergo, and it was Marpa who made trips to India, became the pupil of a great Indian teacher called Naropa, and he brought back many of the great Buddhist scriptures and translated them. And he was known as Marpa the Translator. And he'd already been on his first great trip to India at this stage. He had two more trips to come later on to go and see Marpa, to go and see Naropa. Now, both Marpa and his wife, Dharmema, who was also a great Buddhist teacher, had a dream. And in this dream, there were various portents, and the portents foretold the arrival of a great disciple. And so Marpa made a lot of preparations. He dressed himself up as a monk. He wasn't a monk. He was quite a wealthy householder, a farmer. He had many disciples living with him on his estate. He had a grand house, and servants, and horses, and flocks of sheep, and so on. But very uncharacteristically, he dressed himself up as a monk and went off and started ploughing one of his fields. Now, monks are not allowed to plough, so that's weird. And rich men don't do the ploughing, so that's weird as well. His wife had never seen him do this before. She couldn't understand what was going on. And Milarepa appeared over the horizon, and he'd been asking everybody, where's the great translator, where's the note, and said, oh, we don't know of anyone. And just one person said, well, there's a guy called Marpa who lives down there, you know, and maybe that's him. So Milarepa saw the man ploughing, a big corpulent man with huge staring eyes is the way he's described Marpa, very, very fierce. And he was ploughing, the oxen pulling the plough through the mud, and Milarepa stopped him and said, do you know Marpa the translator? And the ploughman said, yes, I can bring you to him. Could you just help me, though? Could you just take over? I'm a bit tired. And so Milarepa went to it with a will, ploughing the field, and carrying on. And after a while, Marpa said, oh, you can come over now. And Milarepa said, no, I must finish. And he finished ploughing the whole field. And then down to Marpa's house, and to his great surprise, the same man was there sitting on the teaching seat. And eventually, of course, Milarepa realised that is Marpa. And they had this momentous meeting, Milarepa weeping with emotion as he met him. But Marpa knew that he must play it very cool. And he didn't show any sign that he knew that this was his destined greatest disciple who had arrived. And indeed, Milarepa said to Marpa, he said, "Will you give me teachings? Will you give me food and clothing?" Because Milarepa had nothing. And Marpa said to him, well, he said, "You can either have the food and the clothing, or you can have the teaching. Which is it to be?" And without hesitation, Milarepa said, "The teaching. It must be the teaching." And fortunately for him, Dharmema was always very kind to him, Marpa's wife. And she provided him with nourishments and food and so on. Now, I'm not sure how long this story is going to go on for. We've arrived at an important juncture, the meeting between Marpa and Milarepa. So if it starts to get a little bit too long and boring, then there's a signal that you can give me, which is like that. Okay, so I'll look out for that signal. And I'll try and speed up if that starts happening very much. So Marpa became, I would say, a cruel and ferocious taskmaster. He kept on refusing to give Milarepa the teachings. He kept on setting him new tasks. At first he was helping around the house, doing menial work, while the other disciples of Marpa were all being treated as, you know, proper disciples and getting the interesting teachings and going to the fancy pujas and all that kind of thing. And Milarepa wasn't allowed to do that. And before too long, Marpa said, "I've decided what I need you to do, oh great magician." And he always called him great magician. And he'd actually tested out his magical powers by getting Milarepa to get the local bandits to fight amongst themselves by casting a spell. And the most cruel of them died in the fight. And then Marpa said to Milarepa, "Now bring them back to life." And Milarepa said, "Oh, I can't do that." And Marpa says, some magician you are," he said. But he still carried on calling him great magician. And he said, "Great magician, I know you can also build. And what I want is a tower. I want a round tower on the western side of the mountain to mark the boundary of my land." And Milarepa went down there and he gathered earth and clay for cement. He gathered stones and he built this round tower. And before he'd finished the round tower, Marpa came down to see him and said, I've changed my mind. Tear it all down. Put all the stones and earth where you found them. What I actually want is a crescent-shaped tower on the eastern side of the mountain." And Milarepa was a bit put out by this, but off he went, tore it all down, put all the earth and stones away, went to the eastern side of the mountain and started building a crescent-shaped tower. And Marpa came up and said, "What are you doing?" And Milarepa said, "I'm building the tower." He said, "I must have been drunk. I must have been drunk when I told you. No. It's got to be a triangular tower on the northern side of the mountain. So take down the crescent-shaped tower, start..." When I say a tower, it's not like building a snowman or something. This is a genuine fortified tower, a watchtower that he was being asked to build. So it would have been a major task. And he didn't have kangos, he didn't have, what do they call them, JCBs or whatever they're called, all that sort of stuff. No power tools, no help. He didn't even have pulleys, he didn't even have scaffolding. He had to do it by himself. And by the time he'd finished the triangular tower, he had on his shoulder a great bleeding sore from carrying the rocks up to the site and building the tower. And then Marpa had a look at it and he said, "Tear it down," he said. "I never asked you to build a triangular tower on the northern side of the mountain." And Milarepa said, "You did, you did, you did, you did." And Narpa said, I must have been completely crazy. And Milarepa was getting more and more despairing. And Narpa said, tear it all down, tear it all down. And in dejection, Milarepa tore it down. And he said, I've been with you now for years. You have not given me the teachings. You haven't given me the teachings. And he decided to leave. And there was a plot. Dharmema helped him out so that they forged Marpa's signature, and another lama, a great teacher who was one of Marpa's disciples, took him on with this forged signature and some of Naropa's treasures to prove it was genuine. And of course that was discovered, and he was dragged back again, and there was sort of various threats were made, and Marpa became hugely furious with him and threw him bodily out of the house, and he became more and more dejected. But in the end, Dharmema intervened, and both of them talked to Marpa, and they said, but he must have some teaching. He's got to purify himself. He's in terrible trouble. What if he dies without it? And Marpa said, no, don't worry, he said. He said, my teacher, Naropa, went through 12 great ordeals. Each of those ordeals was greater than what you're going through. You have to go through this. So no more whining. He said, but I will grant you the teachings. And Milarepa was very excited. And Marpa said, here are the teachings. The Buddha is the awakened one. The Dharma is the path to awakening. The Sangha is the spiritual community of those who follow the path. Those who follow the path practice the precepts. They practice the precept of not harming living beings. They practice the precept of not taking what is not given. They practice the precept of abstaining from sexual misconduct, of abstaining from untruthful speech, and abstaining from intoxicants that cause carelessness. Now, I've got another tower for you to build. So those were the teachings that Milarepa was given to practice. And Marpa said to him, this is the real one. This is the real one, I promise you. This is to be a great square tower. And the square tower will be 9 stories high. And at the top will be a great parapet. And that tower will be the watchtower on the edge of our village. Now go and build it. And Milarepa said, I don't believe you. And Dharmema was sent for to be the witness. And she said, I don't know if it'll do any good, but yeah. I witness it. He did definitely say that's what he wants, you know, he wants that. So Milarepa started work on the greatest tower of all, and before long he had another sore on his back. The 2 sores were suppurating. He was given a bit of time off to heal from those. And eventually the tower reached the 9th story. But still Marpa would not give him the teachings, and Milarepa became more and more desperate. In fact, he became suicidal, and he went off to the other lama, Ngongtong, I think his name was, who was a kind lama as well as being a very good teacher. And the other lama could see the state he was in, and he said, I'll just stay with him. And he stayed with him while he went through this suicidal phase, and Dharmema tried to talk more and more to Marpa. And eventually, Marpa was persuaded that Milarepa was so desperate that this couldn't go on any longer. And so Marpa called all his disciples together, and he called Milarepa in as well. And it's a little bit like one of those Agatha Christie stories where Hercule Poirot gathers everybody in the room and says, now I am going to explain who is the true victim and who is the true criminal, and so on, you know. And so Marpa explained to everybody what he'd been doing, and he said that Milarepa needed great ordeals. He needed 9 great ordeals corresponding to the 9 stories of the tower. He said he's not finished the parapet at the top. Unfortunately, he's still got some residual karma to deal with. That's your fault, wife, he said. If you hadn't been so kind to him, we could have finished it all off. And Dharmema thought, huh. I don't think he would have survived another day of this, actually, mate. And so Marpa said, but anyway, Now you will receive full teachings, and I will tell you how you can gain full enlightenment in this one lifetime. And Marpa trained him not just in the refuges and precepts, which were already there, but also in meditation practice, in strong transformative meditations, where he could reach down into the inner wiring of his mind and rearrange it and get rid of that terrible splinter of ice, that terrible karma that he built up through his vengeful deeds as a younger man. So Milarepa went off, and Marpa sent him and said, "You must now meditate in solitude." And he went to a cave in the hills above where Marpa lived, and Marpa and Damema would bring him his food every day, and for 11 months he meditated there very, very intensely. After 11 months he had a dream, and in the dream he could see the house with four pillars and eight rafters, or eight beams, which had been rebuilt. But it was in decay, the rain was pouring through the roof. And then he saw his sister Petta begging through the village, a vagabond. And then he saw a heap in the basement of the house, and he realized that that was the body, the dead body of his own mother. And he was intensely affected by this dream, and he left his retreat and he went down to see Marpa and said, "I have to go home, I have to see what's happened." And Marpa gave him permission, and he travelled back to his home village, and everything was exactly as in his dream. He didn't see his sister, but he heard that she was begging from door to door. He went to his house. It was leaking and neglected. His books were mouldy and damp. And then in the basement, he saw a sort of a mound. And in that mound were the bones of his mother. And she'd been dead 8 years. 8 years previously she'd died. And his sister, it turned out, had not even been able to burn or bury the body. She had nothing. She was destitute. And distraught, she'd simply left the house and fled. And the mother's body had been left there to rot. And everybody saw the house as haunted by ghosts of vengeful demons. And what Milarepa did was he sat on the bones of his own mother and meditated for 7 days. And he meditated deeply on his own predicament, on the life of his mother and what she'd been through. He meditated on impermanence, and he meditated on death, and he had a profound and deep realization. And he vowed he would never leave the mountain caves. He vowed he would devote his whole life to deep meditation for the benefit of all beings. And he returned to Marpa, and Marpa knew that this would be their last meeting. And Marpa blessed him and made him vow publicly to spend his life in remote places meditating for the benefit of all beings. And off he went. And for the next 12 years, he moved from cave to cave. One of the caves was halfway up Mount Everest. They're all named, they're all great sacred places nowadays in Tibet, the caves where Milarepa meditated. He would live in these caves. When he first went up there, he took with him a barrow load of food to keep him going, and he managed to make the food, mainly barley flour, last him for 4 years. Then it ran out, and he thought, "I'd better go down to the shops." But then he thought, "No, I cannot break my meditation for even one day." So he looked around him, and he saw the nettles growing there, and he started gathering nettles and any roots and things he could find, and nuts and things, and he made those become his food. And he lived on nettles. He became more and more emaciated. He looked like a skeleton. His skin turned a grey-green colour. Hunters would sometimes find him, and sometimes they would run away in fear when they saw him. on one occasion they just sort of picked him up and started throwing him around the place, you know, rather cruelly. On another occasion, they took pity on him and gave him some food. So occasionally he would get food from passing hunters, but he was living so remotely. And if anyone did discover where he was, he would simply move to another cave. Now, the hunter's stories reached the ears of Petta and Zese, his fiancé. And they decided to try and find him. And Petta went up into the mountains and eventually tracked him down. And she was absolutely horrified when she saw this figure, this grey-green figure, surrounded by nothing, in a desolate cave, in a desolate place. And she said to him, she said, "Until today, I thought I was the most miserable person in the world." She said, "I lost everything. I've lost all my happiness. I've lost my family. But now I realize that there is one who is even more wretched than I am. Brother, that is you." And Milarepa said, "You're mistaken, Petta, you're mistaken. I'm supremely happy," he said. "I'm supremely happy. I'm doing exactly what I want to be doing. I'm discoursing with the Darkenes. I'm dwelling in the void. I'm purifying that sliver of ice that I'd built up in my heart." And Petta said, "Ha!" And she went down and fetched Zese, and they both came up again. And when they came, managed to find him again. By this time, the single cotton cloth he'd been wearing as his covering had rotted away. And he was off getting some water, and he was just prancing about in the rocks naked. And they were both rather prudish, Petta and Zese. They said, "That's disgraceful, that's disgraceful." And he sang them a song about human nakedness and the wonderfulness of the human body and all that kind of thing. So if you look at pictures of Milarepa, you'll often see him at this time, like these pictures here. You'll see him with his single cotton robe, and that's the way he lived even through the winter. Marpa taught him the Tummo practice, which is the practice of the development of inner heat, which enabled him and his disciples, seems to be a quite genuine practice, to survive. And if you think this is cold here, imagine being halfway up Mount Everest in a cave in the middle of winter, and all you're wearing is a cotton sheet, which is rotting away in any case. The red band is a meditation band, and he would lock one or both of his knees into the band, and this holds you upright so that you can meditate all night without falling over. And he would sit on a deerskin mat that was given to him by some hunters. And he's usually shown with his right hand up by his ear like this. And at the stage we're talking about, he's primarily listening to the songs of the Darkenes. The Darkenes, or the Skywalkers, represent all the creative forces that we have within us, but are experienced by the Tibetans as being like strange female dancing figures that appear in the sky and grant deep teachings. Later, this is a little bit more like a folk singer's finger in the ear that he's doing here. You know, you hold your hand like that, and it means you can hear your own voice and you can sing in tune if you do that. So that's why he's holding his hand like that, because he was this great singer. I'll say more about that in a minute. And then the next one to find him was his aunt, of all people. And she made a great trek to look for him because she felt now incredible remorse. Petta and Zese tried to keep her away, but she was determined. And she went up to Milarepa and she begged forgiveness. She said, "My brother, your uncle, has died. I've thought over what we did and I'm just so sorry. Come back to the village. I'll restore you the house. I'll restore you all the land. I'll make sure you're okay." And Milarepa said, "I'm not interested." And he taught her the Dharma. And she practiced the Dharma and later is said to have gained liberation. And Petta also did her best to practice, as did Zese as well, his fiancé. And at the end of 12 years, at last, he gained full and complete enlightenment. And later, when he talked to his own disciples about this, They said, you must be the reincarnation of some great Indian and Tibetan teachers. They were so used to the idea of lineage. But he repudiated this. He said, no. He says, I have no memories of any previous lives. I'm quite sure I was a completely ordinary person. In this life, I was not an ordinary person. I was wicked. To be frank, I was evil. And I simply worked on my own mental states. It was an intensely difficult process, but it's something that anybody can do. Don't think of yourself as hoping that you were some wonderful person in a previous life. So he repudiated that whole system, although the school that he originated soon took it up again. But from his point of view, he said, forget about all that stuff. You know, practice now. This life is what's important. And gradually, after his enlightenment, he just carried on as before. But more and more people would gravitate towards him. And he had a band of disciples around him who are known as the Repas. So you remember, his surname was Miller, and Repa means the cotton clad. And they all wore that single white cotton sheet. They weren't monks. They were simply intense practitioners. And they would live together. He would teach them. He would send them off in all directions to caves to meditate. They would also go down to the villages. There they would teach. They had many, many lay followers as well. But they would never stay long. And as soon as they became popular, as soon as they were offered temples and so on, he said, no, my temple is my own body. I'll never have a monastery. I'll never have a basis. I'll never have an organization. He was very opposed to all that. And amongst his disciples were Retchenpa, I've already mentioned, but also Gampopa, who founded the Kagyupa school of Buddhism. He was interesting because he was a monk, but he was also a great disciple of Milarepa and a great meditator in the caves, the author of The Dual Ornaments of Liberation. And Milarepa spent his life singing his songs. And his voice was beautiful and melodious. He would simply come up with these inspired, poetic utterances, amazing metaphors he would use. My body itself is the monastery. And people were very inspired by these. And still today, he is the most popular and most revered of all the great Buddhist figures of Tibet. And his songs are still sung. His life story is the most popular work of literature in Tibet. He is a really towering figure, which if you think about it, is quite extraordinary, because he avoided people. He did his best to stay away from everybody, but yet his influence was far greater than those who gathered crowds around them with great lectures in big barn conversions and that sort of thing. And he grew older, and I think the story of his death is yet another story again, but there was an academic, a Buddhist academic, who became very, very jealous of Milarepa's popularity when he couldn't even debate properly. He couldn't even use Indian logic properly. So how come he's so popular when I've got all this learning? So this academic sent his girlfriend in to see Milarepa with poisoned yogurt. And she fed Milarepa with the poisoned yogurt. But of course, Milarepa knew full well what was happening. And he said, I know this is poisoned yogurt. I'm going to eat it anyway because I'm now 84 years old. All my main disciples are enlightened. It's time for me to go to the land of the Darkanese. But he first of all said, you will feel intense remorse after this. So I'm going to give you a teaching which will help you break through this remorse and gain enlightenment yourself. And if you can, try and pass this one on to the academic as well. If you can. So she was given the teaching. He ate the curds and he was poisoned. And he lived for some time after this, giving many, many final teachings, some wonderful thoughts in them. I think I'm going to leave the teachings until the next talks, actually, some of the ways that he taught.